From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandi. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the current newspapers. We are expecting shortly the interim chief of police of the Metropolitan Police Department, Peter Newsham. If you have questions or comments for him, you should call now. He won't be here long. 800-433-8850. Send email to kojo@wamu.org or tweet at Kojo Show. Go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream. Ask a question or make a comment there. Tom Sherwood, the Friends of McMillan Park are happy because of a ruling this week by a three-judge appeal court that said that the D.C. Zoning Commission did not adequately justify its decision to allow the proposed development at McMillan Reservoir to exceed zoning limits for the site in the city's comprehensive plan. This was a big deal.
It is a big deal, and it remains a big deal. The Friends of McMillan Park have you know, partly been furious at the media for not covering it more, at least up to this point. This is, for people who don't know, along North Capitol Street, up by Washington Hospital Center, Michigan Avenue Catholic University. This huge open 25-acre space that the city's been wanting to redevelop for years. They came up with a plan, and citizens in the neighborhood said the plan didn't recognize the neighborhood, didn't preserve enough open space, didn't preserve the caverns where this reservoir salt filtration system worked.
It's all my understanding that you used salt. To hang out in those caverns some time ago, but we won't
well,
get into that.
I went by there in the late 60s. I can't remember what I was doing. But then anyway, they've been there a long time. They've been vacant for a long time. And it's dead zone that needs to be developed for the people who live there and for the city. And the citizens sued and said, look, you've trampled historic preservation rules. The Zoning Commission didn't properly consider the intensity and the type of development, the splitting up of the parkland of the 25 acres. And they've won in court now. And the three-judge court said, all right, this goes back to you guys. Work it out.
But here's where you need to go to law school to understand. At the same time, the three-judge court left an opening and apparently said that, yes, even though zoning here does not allow for density, you will be able to build or you should be able to build with density in this area. So it's clearly not over.
No. Well, all development projects can be incredibly complicated. But, you know, the mayor's agent in terms of approving something that's outside what's called the comprehensive plan, there are very strong, if not rules, guidelines about what should be done. And the judges say that the city must go back and redo some of this. There is a pathway to getting it done, but this certainly is a big setback for Mayor Bowser. And before her, you know, Mayor Gray was interested in this.
And before him,
Tony,
right?
Affinity and Tony Williams. What we do know is that people need, in that neighborhood, they need a grocery store, they need parkland, they need access to retail and other issues. And the hospitals, they need space for doctors. It's a really good place to redevelop. It just has to be done with respect to the neighborhood and the historic character of this infiltration.
Well, one of the things that the Friends of McMillan Park fear, and that I know you fear and I fear, is traffic. That when that area is developed, depending on how it's developed, it could become a traffic nightmare. And you've been complaining about the traffic nightmare that the entire city, especially downtown, has become.
Well, and it's in 16th Street. North Capitol Street is a major thoroughfare in town. Michigan Avenue is a major cross street. For anybody who either lives in the area or in Maryland and comes into town, this is a significant place. And traffic has to be considered as part of any development in town. And more importantly, once you have figured out what the traffic's going to be, then this is where I think the city falls down miserably. There has to be traffic enforcement. I just drove across town today from Southwest to get here in Northwest Washington. Had I wanted to and I had the ticket book, I could have written 30 different tickets for people parked in bike lanes, for double parking, for illegal turns, for just, you know, talking on their cell phones or are sending messages. It's stunning how we have so little enforcement. Our traffic probably would be a heck of a lot better if we just enforced the rules we have.
I know you're connected, but you actually have a ticket book that you forgot at home?
I think, well, maybe Chief Newsom, when you get here, maybe he'll give you a ticket book, and I'll write some tickets.
Well, he's walking into the studio right now. Peter Newsom is the interim chief of police with the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. If you have questions or comments for him, call us now, 800-433-8850. You can send email to Kojo at WAMU.org or a tweet at Kojo Show. Chief Newsom, thank you so much for joining us.
Hello, how are you? Sorry I'm late.
Is that okay, Tom?
We're happy to have the chief here. He's got a lot of things on his plate, and we've got a lot of questions in a very short time.
Okay, it's okay for the time being.
This was an unplanned visit, so I apologize. I also apologize that I can't be here as long as you'd like.
This week was marked by dramatic events at the Comet Ping Pong, and by now everybody knows what those events are. There were gunshots there on Sunday. You eventually arrested someone without anybody being hurt. But it's my understanding that threats against the restaurant and neighboring stores had been reported to police before that incident. What did the MPD know about the threats directed against those businesses? And I guess just as importantly, what can police do about threats and harassment online and by phone?
We did have some information prior to the event, you know, this past Sunday, about some threats that had been received by some local businesses. And so what we do when we have a threat like that is we try to get the source. There's a lot of ways nowadays with the Internet that folks can mask where they're calling from. So it makes it difficult on law enforcement. But whenever anyone's threatened, either in person or by phone, we take it very, very seriously.
What did you advise business owners to do? Because it was not just the establishments that were threatened. There were employees threatened and owners threatened. What do you advise people to do in that situation?
You certainly want to let law enforcement know. And then, you know, as you know, in Washington, D.C., we have a very close relationship with our federal partners. And if it's something where we need additional resources to do these investigations, we can get them involved. We frequently have phone threats in other venues across the city, and we have had some success, for example, at the schools for bomb threats and that kind of thing, bringing people who are responsible for those things to justice.
Chief, this young man who was taken into custody was a lone wolf. There's been no indication that he was part of a group or he had just seen stuff on social media. The larger question is, as you have to address these issues, social media is a hotbed of place for people to come up with conspiratorial ideas, to become radicalized, to take matters in their own hands, just as this young man did. We've got the Trump inauguration coming up on January the 20th, certainly one of the most divisive campaigns in our American history, modern American history. Is there anything more, as you're working with the Secret Service and Capitol Hill to get ready for the inauguration, are there things you're doing more because of, like, social media unrest, which is a whole new level that we've never really had before?
Yeah, it's a lot of things rolled into one question. You know, with regards to the situation, the false reporting, the story, and I think it's become pretty clear as this thing materialized this past week, that it can have some very, very serious consequences. I think some people are involved in that type of hoax reporting because they think it's funny, maybe. It's not funny. It's very, very serious. Here you have a neighborhood establishment. The people in this community, as you know, they love. They've embraced these folks in those establishments. And somebody through fake reporting actually caused somebody to come up here and do their own independent investigation. Ended up going into one of our family restaurants with children present with a very dangerous weapon, and actually it scared the community. So it's not funny. This false reporting is not funny. And with regards to the upcoming election...
Inauguration.
You know, we're going to be scouring the social media as well as our federal partners for any potential threats that could occur for the inauguration. And you know this, since about 1865, the Metropolitan Police Department has been involved in inaugurations in this country. I was not there in 1865. That was Lincoln II, but you may have been.
I was nearby.
Yeah. So, but I have been involved in the past seven. We do it very, very well as an agency. We handle demonstrations probably, I would say, better than any other police organization in the country. I think together with our federal partners, we're going to ensure that this peaceful transition of power is exactly that.
And so you'll have to handle the demonstrators who are coming for Trump. Then the next day, there's a women's march. And then, but more importantly, even a week later, is the March for Life, where it may be one of the largest in recent memory, because the hope now and the expectation that a President Trump will do something to appoint justices to the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. So that could be a very big event, less than a week later. That's a lot of strain on
the police. What kind of coordination is involved in that? Because there are a variety of law enforcement agencies that will be involved in ensuring safety at all of those events that Tom talked about. What kind of coordination goes on, and what role will the MPD play?
The coordination is amazing, actually. We're very lucky here in the District of Columbia because we're so small. Many of the federal agencies, they have their field offices right here in the city. I know all the leaders of those organizations. We've been for the inauguration, we've been planning for more than a year.
Right.
After the election, preparations gear up because which candidate is going to be involved. You have the presidential inaugural committee that makes the decisions on where the balls are going to be and that kind of thing. But the coordination, in my opinion, here in the district, and I've been to other cities where the coordination and the relationships between local and federal law enforcement are not as good as they are here. All of the federal agencies are bringing in additional personnel. I think it's been pretty widely reported that we have about 3,000 officers coming in from across the country to assist us with this thing.
Yeah, even nearby, like Montgomery County, Arlington, the whole community gets involved in this.
They do. In fact, the other law enforcement organizations, we kind of take it for granted here in Washington, D.C., to participate in the inauguration. But they're very happy to do it, to be a part of the event.
It's history.
It's history, exactly right.
A D.C. police officer was suspended after taking underage interns to bars, among other conduct. She has been, according to reports, reinstated on the force. She played an important role as the head of the LGBT liaison unit. I know there are some personnel restrictions that will prevent you from talking explicitly about this, but I guess the question is, if I took underage people to a bar to drink, I would probably get arrested, but yet I understand this officer's back on the street. Why?
This is I think it's been pretty widely reported. This is a supervisor in our special liaison unit, and she is a transgender, and anyone who knows the story of this particular supervisor, she's a pretty remarkable person. She has overcome quite a bit in her life to get to the point where she is, particularly in a law enforcement organization. She has not been suspended. There has been an allegation of misconduct. The allegation is being going through the disciplinary process. One of the things I will say about this particular person is that she is human, as are all of my police officers. My police officers are human, and they do make mistakes. When they are allegations of misconduct, we take it very, very seriously, and we let the disciplinary process run its course. The idea behind any discipline is to prevent the behavior from happening again. If we're confident that the discipline that is necessary prevents anything from happening again, then we've done what we need to do. The one of the things that I will say, too, about this particular incident, because we talk about bias all the time. We talk about bias in policing, implicit bias. I'm hopeful. I have almost 400 sergeants on the Metropolitan Police Department that this one isn't getting the attention it is because of somebody's bias out there because of this particular person.
It sounds like you feel it might be.
I think it could very well be. Like I said, I have 400 sergeants on the Metropolitan Police Department, and all of a sudden discipline surrounding this particular sergeant is a story. And that gives me some pause.
Well, when something is a story and we find out about it, we ask questions about it.
Oh, absolutely. I get that. I understand. I completely, and that's part of your job.
And you'll take whatever, it won't take a long time to work through this for whatever disciplinary actions might have to be taken.
Correct.
Okay. Do we have time to ask about police cameras? We're about, every officer on the force is going to have 2,400 of them going to have cameras.
Yep, we're very excited about that. We rolled them out this year, and we had a very aggressive rollout. We have a very unique study that's being done here in Washington, D.C., which is going to show us the effectiveness of the body-worn cameras. Our study is unique in the fact that we've been able to implement it with so many officers. We initially rolled out about 1,300 of the cameras, about half the cameras. We're going to compare those 1,300 cameras and the officers and the things that, they've encountered with the cameras and how things may be different with the 1,300 officers that did not have cameras. So we'll have a really, really good study. It's about a seven-month study. It'll give us some answers as to whether or not these cameras are actually effective.
And really quick, if I may, a lot of us in the media would like to do freedom of information requests to see the video, which sometimes cases has to be blanked out in part so you don't have anybody innocent shown. But is there a budget for that now? But there was some concern that would cost both a lot of staffing time and money.
That's a great question, because I think we anticipated that it was going to cost a lot. We anticipated a lot more requests than we're actually getting.
That's a compliment to your police officers.
I hope so. Yes, sir. I hope it is. So it looks like something we're going to be able to manage. We're going to try and turn those things around as quickly as we can. One of the criticisms is that, we don't get them out there as quickly as we can, but there is a redaction process that takes time.
Okay. Here is Sherry in Washington, D.C. Sherry, you're on the air with Chief Newsham. Go ahead, please.
Great. Thank you, Coach Joe, and holiday greetings to everyone. Chief, I think there's going to be a stain on the department until there is an arrest and prosecution made in the horrific rape that occurred at the Dodge Mansion owned by MC Dean that was recently reported in the Washington Post. I don't understand why that person isn't in custody. The message that, it seems to have just been swept under the rug other than the articles I read in the newspaper about it. And it, it sends the wrong message. It says if you're rich, white, and well-connected, you can commit rape, at a semi-public event and get away with it. What is the state of the investigation on that horrific incident at the Dodge Mansion that was recently reported in the Washington Post?
Chief Newsham.
Yeah, that's a great question, and I know there are a lot of concerns about that case in particular. Because it's an ongoing investigation, I can't talk to it in detail, but I can tell you it is still being investigated between the Metropolitan Police Department and the U.S. Attorney's Office. I can say this because there was some criticism that I did see in the local papers about the way that the case was handled. Somebody suggested that the police department should have put out a lookout, and I think somebody even suggested that the police department should have somehow forced the victim to go to the hospital for treatment in that case. And first of all of the parties that were involved in that particular case, we knew about that. We knew exactly everybody that was involved in the case. And the second thing, and for anyone who's had any familiarity with investigating sexual assaults, it's a victim-centered approach. You really have to. You've had a person who's just had a trauma in their life that's inexplicable, and us as police officers have to be sensitive to that. We have to understand that the victim has just gone through this trauma. Forcing somebody who's in that situation to do anything, everything we know is the wrong thing to do. So I did want to clear up those two criticisms of our agency in that particular case, and I want to assure you that we are going to continue to investigate it until we can bring it to a successful conclusion.
Is the U.S. Attorney's Office leading that investigation, since it's not or is that some of the police department's doing and the U.S. Attorney's Office is helping, or is it just a joint operation?
The way that it works is, we bring all the information that we have in any one of those cases over the U.S. Attorney's Office, and then a decision is made whether or not charges would be appropriate.
He specifically said if you're rich and white and you live in mansions in Georgetown, you're going to be treated differently. What about that in those cases?
I can tell you from my perspective, if you break the law, we have a responsibility to safely and respectfully bring you into custody, regardless of who you are. One of the great things I think about Washington, D.C., is our diversity and our respect for diversity in this city. I think a lot of people feel the same way as the caller does. That people who have money can somehow buy their way out of these situations. But all I can let you know is that's not our inclination on the Metropolitan Police.
Courtland Malloy in the Post wrote about the arrest of the young man at the Comet Pizza ping pong place that if that person had been black, he might not have gotten such a calm arrest. Now, he wasn't saying specifically about your police department, but just police in general. Had the been a black person who'd gone into a pizza joint and shot it up and then tried to walk out might not have come out so peacefully.
Yeah, that's a national criticism of law enforcement across the country. And, you know, we have to be cognizant of that, of police. And I think I'm actually glad you asked that question, because what has not been reported in the Comet Ping Pong case is the heroic action by not only the employees, but the members of the Metropolitan Police Department who were able to bring an armed gunman into custody safely. That's one of the things we pride ourselves on, is to be able to safely and respectfully take violent offenders into custody. And a part of the story that has not been told, I don't think, you know, you had a man come into a restaurant with families who were dining. And, you know, this is not too widely known, but the employees in that restaurant recognized this as an armed gunman. And they started to safely get all of the guests out of the restaurant into the street without any real concern or regard for their own safety, which is pretty remarkable, pretty heroic.
Peter Newsham is the interim chief of police with the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. Chief Newsham, Tom Sherwood would like a book on which he can write tickets for people. He said he could have written 32 tickets on the way over here today.
I know the traffic division of the police department has kind of defaulted some of that enforcement to the Public Works Department and traffic control officers. But it's stunning to me the traffic violations downtown, double parking. I saw a police car just pass by a truck that was blocking a lane and a bike lane. And I was thinking, a little tap of the siren horn there, and, hey, buddy, move on, that might have been to help traffic. Where are you guys in enforcing traffic?
We got about 15 seconds left.
And I've got 40 minutes of questions. Go ahead.
With traffic, I think you're absolutely right. If that's a specific circumstance where an officer could have used their emergency equipment to move the vehicle, they should have done that. If it didn't happen in that circumstance, I apologize. So we have to make our officers cognizant of the frustration that drivers feel when people are blocking traffic across our city. And then we also have to ask the public, which is actually going to be more helpful, to understand when they do stop in a travel lane that they're just creating frustration, unnecessary frustration for us.
Neil Albert of the Downtown Business.
Chief Newsham, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Traffic downtown is horrific.
Take a short break. Peter Newsham is the interim chief of police with the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking with Adam Eben. He is a member of the Virginia State Senate. If you have questions for him, start calling now, 800-433-8850. I'm Kojo Nandi.
Hi, it's Diane. The next meeting of my book club is on Wednesday, May 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern. I'll host a discussion of Mad Honey by Jodi Picco and Jennifer Finney Boylan, followed by a conversation with the authors. Find out more and register at dianereem.org/bookclub.
We're joined by Adam Eben. He's a member of the Virginia State Senate, Democrat representing District 30. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Even if you wanted to go to the opening of the MGM Grand last night, you probably couldn't go because it was so backed up that they had to cut off exits from the Wilson Bridge going over there, so you probably couldn't go. But Tom Sherwood has a reason that a lot of people probably shouldn't go.
Well, I just think one of the issues, I didn't get a chance to do a story on this, but is the gambling anonymous, or the people who have problems with gambling. Maryland has a statewide phone number. The casinos are required by law to caution against gambling. But, you know, the whole point of the gambling casinos is to lure you in. I was going to do a story about people should worry about it. My rule in gambling, I go about once every 3 years to Atlantic City, is gamble with no more money than you would just be willing to throw into the Potomac River. That's what I do. And then it's much more fun than you can have fun. But the things are designed to lure you in, senior citizens with fixed incomes, people stopping to playing the lottery and going. Apart from all the glitz, there's a lot of worry, and from me, about what happens.
Prince George's County says that they want it because it's going to be a revenue driver in Prince George's County. There are no casinos in the Commonwealth of Virginia, and I suspect that Prince George's County is anticipating a lot of traffic coming from Virginia.
I think they are, and I'm hoping that we remain casino-free in Virginia. Wish them luck, but I know that a lot of times those, particularly electronic games, are lure you into a trance the way they have the technology. And, you know, a huge percentage of the gamblers, of the winnings for the casino come from a small percentage of the visitors.
The Washington Post.
Georges County is also looking at 4,000 new jobs being created and a lot of tax revenue.
And many of those jobs in Prince George. And again, that's why it's all a good thing, part of the National Harvest development. But there's something like the Washington Post reporters did a story. There's something like 50 casinos in the northeastern United States. Now, Virginia has never shown any interest in it. But there are some Indian tribes, federally recognized Indian tribes, that might have a way of opening a casino. What would you think about that?
I'm opposed to casino gambling in Virginia, however it comes. I don't know the federal rules for that. But we have had people have actively tried to get casino gambling through a committee that I sit on in the Senate, and it's not something I support.
Do you support the state lottery?
It sounds hypocritical. I didn't vote for the lottery. It was before I was in the General Assembly. But that's there, and I accept it.
Alexandria has been debating what will happen to its Confederate symbols. It seems a statue of a Confederate soldier will stay, but Jefferson Davis Highway will be renamed. First, the statue. This would seem to be a local matter, but in this case, the General Assembly would have to be involved. Can you explain?
Sure. In 1889, the General Assembly passed a law saying that the monument shall perpetually remain as it is presently erected and located, and that it cannot be repealed, altered, or revoked by any future city council or municipal authority. So it's up to the state if there was to be any effort to move the statue.
And you and others from the General Assembly representing Alexandria declined to request a waiver to the rules that prohibit moving war memorials, even though the city council in Alexandria voted to have it removed. But why?
Well, to start with, there's no appetite in Richmond to be able to pass that kind of a bill. It would be a symbolic bill, and I don't think the community is united on moving that particular statue.
Well, the law you cited, it can't be moved, altered,
altered, modified, or changed by any future council or other municipal power authority. That's the 1889 law, and we've passed similar laws in the 1950s.
And you would have to request a waiver.
But there's a simple solution. This is like what Cuba did with the American embassy in Cuba when they put up a news ticker on the front of the American embassy in Cuba to broadcast news to the people who couldn't get news in Cuba. Fidel Castro put up a bunch of flagpoles and flags and right in front of it, and you couldn't see the news ticker. So why don't you just put up some flags in Alexandria and block it?
Let's just either leave it the way it is or not.
I'm just trying to stir up trouble.
You certainly are. I don't think it's trouble. The one thing I'd like to see us do is honor more of the Union side, or particularly African American contributions in Alexandria. Market Square in front of City Hall was a large slave market, and I'd like to see that more prominently recognized.
You know,
the Confederacy lasted for all of 4 years, and slavery lasted for several hundred years.
So that's right.
Appropriate that you should.
Well, I was at Antietam last weekend on Sunday when they had the Illumination Day. 23,100 real candles, not fake ones, spread out over the battlefield for the wounded people. 6,000 to 8,000 people, I think, died, and all of those wounded. It brings back the Civil War thing, and I understand the history of Virginia being in the heart of the Civil War battles. It seems to me that we shouldn't move monuments we have, but explain the ones we have better.
Yeah, and introduce some new ones.
And maybe some new ones. Kojo Monument.
800-433-8850 if you have questions for Senator Eben. Some are not happy about changing the highway's name nor moving war memorials like the Confederate statue. They feel it erases history. Alexandria is soliciting new names for the Jefferson Davis Highway, and the number of people have weighed in. Do you have a particular preference for a name?
Sure. Mine's kind of boring. I would just call it Richmond Highway because that's what it's called in Fairfax.
Yeah, a lot of people would like to see it called Richmond Highway. I'm surprised that Sherwood doesn't have a name of his own that he'd like to call it.
I actually think calling it the Richmond Highway makes sense. That's what it is and was and will be.
President-elect Donald Trump has promised that he will shrink the federal workforce while promising to beef up the military. Both federal employees and the military are important economic drivers in Northern Virginia. What do you think a Trump presidency will mean for your district?
Well, for federal workers, and we have a lot of them, and the threat of cuts is challenging, but it's particularly demoralizing, I would think, for a federal worker to work for cabinet secretaries or agency heads who oppose the very mission of their department. to work for the head of the EPA, who's against environmental protection, or the secretary of HUD, who doesn't support all our fair housing laws, wouldn't want to make me go into public service. And we have some really talented people from this region, and we'd like them to continue to enter public service.
Well, you know, there have been, back to the Reagan era, the Reagan Revolution, it's been a mantra of the Republican Party to cut the size of government.
Get rid of the education department?
If you can remember which one it is. But it hasn't happened. I mean, there have been cutbacks in the sequestration, which has been terrible for various budgets, including the military budgets. But the growth of the government has occurred with the growth of the country. So I'm just wondering, how fearful should people be if they think their federal jobs are going to be wiped out en masse?
I don't know how quickly something like that could happen en masse, and whether the Senate would go along with particular cuts en masse. So I would keep an eye on it, but this isn't a time that I'd want to go to work for the EPA as a new employee.
Well, say first, last in, first out, or whatever that phrase is.
Right.
A number of public officials in our region have reported an uptick in racial and hate-based incidents. Are you aware of any increase in Virginia at all?
Yeah, there have been three hate crimes that have been reported since the election. I don't have details on all of them. The Southern Poverty Law Center documented one case in Arlington where a woman was crossing the street and reported that two young men in a car shouted at her, "Be ready, because with Trump we can grab your pussy." There were women, but we have a really rich immigrant community in Northern Virginia, especially with Latino and Muslim immigrants, and I want them to feel safe.
Maryland has set up a hotline to report incidents of this kind. What might the response be in Virginia if there is indeed a continuation of an increase in these kinds of incidents?
Well, I have great confidence in our Department of Public Safety investigating things, but the real problem with hate crimes is people who don't report them. People who are fearful or ashamed or don't want to call attention to their immigrant status or otherwise are just embarrassed.
And also, look what happens on social media now. If you criticize the president-elect or a candidate, or you say something complimentary about the Comet Pizza place, you get bombarded with all kinds of... I'm a big believer in free speech. I'm reluctant to say this, but at some point there ought to be people held accountable for their intimidation.
Well, the problem is that starting at the top with bullying someone who really from the top, you know, from the administration, the new president who likes to assert his dominance over everything in any way he can through Twitter or otherwise, it's not really a great example. I mean, at this point, regardless of party, it's one thing to hope for, a good presidency, success for the policies you believe in. But, you know, I believe the president should be a unifying figure, from just as Ronald Reagan was, not mean-spirited.
Well, Reagan was certainly reviled by the Democrats during that campaign. And, you know, that bozo actor, you know, B-grade actor. I mean, and there was a lot of public humiliation of him, an attempt at it.
Well, Trump is making me nostalgic for Reagan.
Oh, that's the news of the day right there.
It looks like there are new details about the future FBI headquarters. It's going to be just one building, not 12 or 14 separate buildings. And if public transportation is a priority, that would point to Maryland over Springfield, Virginia for the project. What are your thoughts about it?
We do have a Springfield-Franconia metro station near the parcel. I don't know the details of how close the Maryland station is to the site, but we would certainly like those jobs in Virginia. I know our federal delegation is doing what they can to get them.
You'd think, well, you know, Governor Hunt, I keep getting the Governor Hunt mixed up with the Governor of Maryland.
Hogan.
He wants the FBI there, and he didn't support Trump. Maybe you could get Trump to have a hissy fit over this and give it to Virginia just to show Hogan that he should have been more supportive.
I will start tweeting as soon as we leave.
You know, the governor, he's going to be sitting at the Army-Navy game. He's going to have to sit on one side of the field and then the other with President-elect Trump. I'll be anxious to see what they talk about.
It'll be anxious to see if they talk. 2017 means statewide elections in Virginia, including governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general. in the wake of the Donald Trump victory in the election? Of course, he did not win Virginia, but what does the landscape look like for Democrats in those statewide races at this point?
Well, I'm feeling pretty good. We just defeated a constitutional amendment that was placed on the ballot as a inducement to get Republicans to vote. It was a right-to-work constitutional amendment, which was not forecast to be defeated, and it lost by an even bigger margin than Trump did. We're the only battleground state that Hillary Clinton improved performance for the Democrats in 2016 over 2012. So those are good signs. That said, it's still an off year, not a federal year, so we have to work hard to turn out our vote. But there's a lot of new energy, renewed energy, and revitalization in the Democratic Party. Unfortunately, it's after the election, even though we did, you know, I wish we had seen it nationally. But I go to a local Democratic committee meeting, and I find 23 new members.
Do you think that's sustainable? Because people get fired up over an election and they feel a great deal of anger or worry about it, and then they fade away as the day goes by.
I think President-elect Trump will effectively encourage them to channel their feelings after the election. I think he'll keep it up, unfortunately.
General Assembly session begins January 11th. What's specifically on your agenda for that session?
Well, I'm going to continue my work to pass a constitutional amendment to allow for us to have a two-term governor. I've got some legislation to bring some fairness to consumers in the hot lanes. Right now, when they receive a big bill and are hauled into court, the judges don't have any discretion over their fees from the private contractor who operates the lanes. I'm also working on some marijuana policy changes. The one I'm most optimistic about is to stop taking driver's licenses away from marijuana offenders. All the states were mandated to do this at one point, and more than 33 of them no longer take them away, including every state surrounding Virginia. And I have a Republican co-chief patron in the Senate. There will be a House Republican version of the bill. We're working with prosecutors, so I'm really trying to build a big coalition for it this year.
See if that works out.
Is that a demonstrable number of people who have lost their licenses on marijuana use?
Yeah. They're suspended for 6 months. And
hundreds? Thousands?
Tens of thousands. During the 6 months after you get the offense, you have a provision where if you don't choose to plead guilty, you can lose your license, which you would do anyway if you're found guilty.
Adam Eben is a member of the Virginia State Senate. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Tom Sherwood, very briefly, Mayor Muriel Bowser of the District of Columbia met with President-elect Donald Trump during the course of this past week, but we practically know nothing about what was discussed.
She said they had a nice meeting, 40 minutes. There was no photo afterwards, and he didn't come out and talk about the meeting. There are some reports that Mark Seagrave said she may have talked about the RFK Redskins Stadium in the District of Columbia as one item where the president-elect
may
have.
But why the secrecy?
Well, I'm going to send another message and ask.
We're hoping to have her here as a guest next week on this broadcast.
Can I say very quickly, she wasn't obviously for Trump. She's a Democrat, but she says as the mayor of the nation's capital, she has to be gracious with whomever is the president, and that's the right approach.
And that's it for the show today. But if you've got holiday shopping lists for kids and teens to tackle, we've got some guidance on books to give to the young readers in your life. Our winter reading list for little ones, teens, and families is up at kojoshow.org/blog. Local author and illustrator Juana Medina, librarian extraordinaire Edie Ching and Rachel Walker of Reading Rockets have shared their top picks with us so we can share them with you. Check out their suggestions at kojoshow.org/blog. Today we say goodbye to our amazing interns, Daniel Verghese and Prachi Parmar. They actually did all the work on this show. The producers and the rest of us just take the credit for it. But they are amazing and we wish them all the best. Be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon. We'll discuss the future of two local historic sites. First, a court ruling recently put the brakes on the controversial redevelopment of the McMillan sand filtration sites. Then, after several attempts to reinvent the Carnegie Library as an arts venue, the century-old landmark may house an Apple store, among other things. That's all coming up Monday at noon. Until then, enjoy your weekend. Thank you all for listening. Tom Sherwood, you have a good weekend.
I intend to.
I'm Kojo Namdi.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show. And if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.